Okay, so let's talk about, if you don't mind, let's actually, I just want to make sure that there are no lingering questions or observations about mindfulness of thoughts and emotions, and then the open presencing, choiceless awareness meditation practices. Are there any questions or confusions around those practices, or anything to report? Yeah, so who has a mic? Okay, we'll get to the mic. Yeah.
Maybe it isn't better. Did he leave us any better? No. Very efficient. Yeah.
Welcome to Israel.
I'm practicing just picking the root hand before, and I found it difficult. And today, I found it difficult as well. When we go to the open awareness, then I became sleepy and it was difficult to maintain the alert and focus. And before when we and even when we focused on the thoughts, I felt like I was alert and I managed to do that. And that's it, I want to ask you to think about continuing.
I think the idea that it's very difficult is already probably just a story in your head. It's not any more difficult than anything else. It's just awareness. So if you're resting in awareness with thoughts and there's vividness, what's the problem to just rest in awareness with anything? So that you can also investigate, see what's going on there. Or, you know, or the breath, or whatever, same awareness. So over time you can experiment with just maybe, again, tiny little moments of it as opposed to trying to sort of make that the whole of the meditation practice. And then you get a little toehold in the open presence. Just a moment, then go back to. Most people find thought really difficult to stay in awareness of their thoughts without getting caught in the thought. So if you are awake and observing the thoughts coming and going without, for the most part, getting caught in them, that's pretty significant. But it's really no different. It's just objects, when you select the object versus objects that arise randomly without selection, or not so randomly. So I wouldn't be too concerned about that. I certainly wouldn't give up on the choice of awareness if you have some kind of intuition that it would be useful to you. And if not, then of course, you know, that goes for all the practices. Just use what feels right to you, and gradually over time, since it is the same awareness, it will expand all by itself. So, I know that, where's the microphone now? Going back to here, right? Okay, hold on a second. Can I take him, and then we'll take it.
Okay. I want first to say a word of appreciation to John for the generosity and the gentleness with which you share your wisdom with us. Again, appreciate me. He's coming here and I just wanted to express that. And if it is okay for you now or some later time, you were talking about chronic conditions that people are living with, pain and so on. If you could also relate to people with terminal illness and sometimes it is a privilege to accompany them. And any thoughts, just appreciate.
Okay, thank you. Well, obviously this is a very, very short retreat, and so the degree to which we can bring all different applications of mindfulness or heartfulness into is limited. But to just say, I don't really have anything to say about it now other than that everything that we've already been doing completely applies, being fully present with the other, not having an agenda, recognizing their, how they are in relationship to their own dying, for instance, or what's going on with the body, and leaving their family behind or whatever it is. This is a complex terrain. Everybody's different. So it's not a matter of, like, we know how to die and we're going to now impose it on everybody. Some naive people actually do that or start out that way, where there's like a good way to die and we're going to teach it to you whether you want it or not. But of course, we're not talking about that. We're talking about being exquisitely sensitive and really being in a wise relationship. So virtually everything that we've done over this period of time applies in one way or another, and the creative edge is how to utilize your own expertise and your own love and your own commitment to being with the other in that kind of circumstance to allow what can emerge to emerge. And it will be different in every single case. And of course, there's a huge literature and many people doing this kind of end-of-life care and through mindfulness, and then there's the Zen Hospice Project, and there's the work of Joan Halifax, who's been doing what she calls eating with dying for many, many years. And so the integration of mindfulness into this is something that's been going on for quite some time. I guess that you've been doing it yourself.
I appreciate how short the time and how impossible it is to understand how what the implication it could be, but still I try to see whether I could understand something which is that being a therapist working with parents and children, usually as I work I try to find a way how to label the emotion correctly, accurately. And I know that the names of the emotion as accurate are very healthy self-regulating emotions. So there I found out that when you were talking about pain, you were trying to either rename or delete the name. And I was working in between, and I was a bit confused, and I thought, how would I apply the mindfulness while I was doing, you know, it sounds contradictory, so stop. I'm sure.
Ah, that's a beautiful question. Obviously, we need names and we need thinking. If we, you know, we would be in very bad shape if we didn't think it's one of the most beautiful human characteristics, and we decategorize aspects of reality and make connections on the basis of naming and thinking and new realizations arise because of that kind of thing. And of course, science is all involved with naming and describing and understanding the lawfulness of interconnection and so forth. So this, of course, that's a very important part of it. At the same time, sometimes it's helpful if we don't take the names and the forms all that seriously. So we know that they are relatively important, but they may not be absolutely essential. So sometimes we need to let go of the names and the forms. And that would really in part depend on who you're working with, what kinds of things you're working with. And sometimes once the connections are made that way, cognitively or in whatever way you're making them, then to move beyond that might require letting go so that it's not the kind of defining characteristic of everything from that moment on. It's just a door that opened and allowed you to see things in a new way. So I don't think there's any contradiction between the domain of before naming, okay, before thinking, and then the domain of thinking. But when you're only stuck in thought, then you create concepts, and sometimes the concepts substitute for the reality when you are in the domain of the kind of non-verbal direct experiencing, then that can be extremely valuable, but sometimes you need the words. And so in order to talk
these opposing capacities. One is evolved to a very great degree through our education system, the other gets almost no attention at all. So the path of mindfulness in some ways is the middle way between these two worlds, but we need to be able to inhabit both of them. And so we're learning how to inhabit the forms. I don't know if you're familiar with the Zen tradition and Mahayana Buddhism and so forth, but the highest teachings of Mahayana Buddhism are what is called the Heart Sutra, which is a very short sutra. But the Heart Sutra is part of this kind of non-dualistic orientation, that the deep structure of all this meditative tradition is non-dual. As soon as you make the difference between this and that, you've created separation. And this is saying, ultimately, there's non-duality. It's only sort of unity, okay? But it manifests in thousands of different ways. So the Heart Sutra, for instance, will say, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue. So all of the senses, they're not, you know, say, no eyes, no ears, because these are all concepts. No eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, no sense of self. And then it will say, no ignorance, no ignorance. It's all about delusion and ignorance, and now I'm saying there is no ignorance. Because as soon as you conceptualize ignorance, you've actually reified something that is smaller than the actuality. Is it helpful? Sometimes. Yes, of course. We need the word ignorance. But we also need no ignorance and no extinction. In other words, and then it gets more radical than that. Listen to this. No suffering. That's the first noble truth. Out the window. No suffering, no origination, in other words, no cause for the suffering, that's the second culture. No cessation, no stopping, no cessation, that's the third culture, and no path. The eightfold no path, well, that's the fourth culture. Out the window. So, mindfulness is non-dual from the very beginning. And it's very, very important to us in the mindfulness-based intervention stream of things to teach it from the very beginning as a non-dual meditation practice. And so we emphasize, as you've heard me say over and over again, there's no place to go. People come, they're suffering, they want to go somewhere, they want tools, they want something to fix them, they want all sorts of things they want. And we say the best way to get someplace is to not try to get any place at all. Wow, it sounds very Zen, right? But actually, it's pointing at a certain kind of truth that is the truth of non-duality, non-separation.
Thank you very much.
So, we'll take a few more.
Yeah. Wow, it was so profound, and I feel like I'm in another place for my questions from before, but I'll just go back for a second. If you can say some more about the world of investigation, because I always have a question of confused about if when it comes to kind of investigate whatever comes up, which is kind of like in my psychotherapist straight mind, it's always kind of getting to a loop of thought, by the alteration of thought. And I just don't know how to kind of, just kind of like seeing and naming or not naming, that's okay, but kind of investigating it to confuse.
Thank you for, since I've used the word investigating so much, I really appreciate your asking about that. So what I mean by investigating, let's start with appearances and the actuality. So we agree that things sometimes appear a certain way, but that's not actually the way they are. That there are sort of like, there's the surface reality and then there's the entire case. And sometimes we just interpret what's going on from the surface. And we don't look deeper. And many examples have been given even this morning about like, well, on the surface it looks like maybe the war is tomorrow. When we look more deeply, it's much more complicated than that. Okay, so what I mean by investigation is not thinking. It's not a thought-based process. It's a peeling back of the
or looking beneath the surface of appearances and attending moment by moment in open presence to whatever arises. Okay? And usually what arises is seeing connections that we may not see before. And we investigate and we see, okay, if I put awareness in my knee that hurts, and I no longer call it my knee, I just call it the knee. So I don't call it anything, and I just attend to it. What happens to the suffering? That's a little laboratory experiment, right in your own body. So that's what I mean by investigating. On the surface of it, you say, my knee killing me, this meditation sucks, I don't want any more of it, goodbye. But you could also say, okay, what an opportunity. I can now investigate. I know that if I get up, the pain will go away. So the perfect laboratory experiment to investigate the nature of my own suffering. And how much of it is, am I contributing? Yes, there's a sensation in the knee. And if I can just let the sensation be the sensation, I can discuss maybe. I'm not saying this is a kind of truth, but it's an invitation to look. Maybe it's actually not pain at all. Maybe it's just intense sensation. And then I notice something in me calling it pain, just the way something when I hear the tweet tweet, the same bird very quickly. But I'm not hearing a bird, and I don't see a bird, I'm hearing. So that's what I mean by investigation. And it can be applied in virtually any domain. When we see the surface and we see how attached we are to the surface understanding, and often we are very attached to it, and we have a big narrative about it. And so something as simple as asking, is that so? Can feel that. And then we see the deep structure. And then maybe something new, imaginative, creative emerges, and maybe not, you know, I mean, it's not like every time you look, you're going to have some kind of epiphany. But if you begin to cultivate the soil in this kind of way, it can become a very reliable way to navigate our own life and not get caught in a lot of the superficial stuff we tell ourselves, like that thought, this is killing me, I can't stand it anymore, this is awful. Where did it come? Once you start believing those thoughts, you create that reality, and you don't want to hear about any deeper reality because you've already written it off. So that's kind of imprisonment. And to not write it off and peeling back the surface is liberating, right? Then and there. And not in an insignificant way either. And we see this all the time in the stress reduction plan. People will actually have the experience of, we never say this, never, ever say this. People will have the experience after a few weeks, I'm not my cancer. I'm not my cancer. Or I'm bigger than my story of my heart attack. Because when you go to the hospital, everybody treats you like a cancer patient or a heart attack patient. And they forget the person. Unless they've been very well trained and have a new culture of medicine, which has a long way to go in the United States, but still. People, it's much better than it was 20 years ago. So that's a deep realization. I'm not a cancer. Little things like that are actually enormous, and they are very freeing, and they come out of investigating in the way that I'm describing. And it's not a cognitive investigation, but it doesn't mean that you give up your cognitive intelligence. So they can be brought to bear too, and that allows us to talk about them and to use names and words and so forth. But what we're talking about comes from someplace before words. It's another form of intelligence.
Thank you.
Thank you. Where did you want to go? Okay, yes. And will you take the microphone? We're going to migrate it over.
Stand up or raise your hand. Okay, please.
I'm actually thinking of the opportunity to share about your mind. And I'd like to ask you about thoughts. And I think this is the hardest issue for me. And actually, I don't know what are they. You can define more of the what it is.
Sure.
Perhaps. I think if
Thank you for hearing that.
Can you say more about this program? More about your future?
Yeah. First of all, could I ask you, have you been practicing in this way, cultivating mindfulness, for a long time? It's just your own personal practice? Okay. And is paying attention to thoughts a salient part of your practice? Has it been a salient part?
Never been.
Okay. So, in a sense, it's very unusual to bring that to the attention. So Goethe, the famous German polymath scientist, writer, philosopher, Goethe is famous for having said, every object well contemplated creates the organ for its experience. Every object well contemplated creates the organ for its experience. So for instance, even here, okay, where we, it's obvious what the organ is, the organ system, of course it includes all sorts of, you know, distributed brain networks, so it's not just in here. But there are different levels of attuning in one's ear. An orchestra conductor, for instance, will hear a symphony very differently from the way I would hear a symphony. It's almost as if like two different experiences. Because he's trained his ear, or she is trained her ear to keep it away. And so they're hearing things that don't even exist. Same as seeing. There's an art to see. And how we see makes a huge difference. And anybody who paints or draws knows that, you know, this is like a whole domain. So you can not only, you can exercise the organ, you can develop the organ and extend the organ so that it's really very different from just eyes or just ears. And they're miraculous enough by themselves. So now thoughts, what are thoughts? You said you don't know what thoughts are. Well, welcome to the club. No one knows what thoughts are. Even neuroscientists, you could ask Nava here, but I'm guessing that, you know, no neuroscientist really can say what a thought is. Obviously, it has something to do with, you know, neuronal firing, but whether they're localized or non-localized, how this works, I mean, no one has a right idea. And that tiny little nothing that influences our lives enormously. If your mind just comes up with one tiny little disturbing thought, it can be seriously disturbing, right? We all know that. But when you start to pay attention to you, try to just watch the process of thought arising, passing, arising, passing, arising, passing. We all have content, we all have some kind of meaning, although often it's not clear what it is, and how one thought relates to the next, but it's just coming, going, coming, going. And it's so fast, and you're so far, you start to pay attention to them, and it's like, you can't find them. We don't know what they are. They're actually, it's disorienting, even. And we're not hunting, just the same way we're not hunting the sound. We're not listening for them, going out, searching for them, bringing them back. We're simply waiting for them to pass away. And the more you practice this, the more you cultivate that organ. And we call that organ awareness. But when awareness is exercised around thoughts and emotions, it transforms. It becomes more cognitively and emotionally aware and intelligent, and it's discerning. And therefore the landscape becomes more vivid as opposed to just thoughts that plague us.
I see you. I'm using my name and I need to cover this part. I have been hard to find when senses, when thoughts.
It's all these things we expect to get. You're seeing me, you're hearing me, and also you have a concept of me that is true to a degree. You've known me in certain ways for a day and a half.
certain way. So there's seeing, hearing, all of that, and there's also consciousness. And there's also emotions, because that's what moves us. So even having a sensation is an element of emotion, of connection, one human being talking with another, trying to be quiet together. So there's also, you know, that. And well, you know, we're not going to understand this or come to some kind of resolution by my thinking or talk. It's just sufficient in this moment to name it, that, oh, this is whole domain of thinking, and we have a very strange relationship to it. And we can get more intimate with it if we put it sort of under the electron microscope or the microscope, and begin to actually observe the phenomenon, itself. Okay? And then that observation is a sort of kind of investigating, because we're putting a lens up here. We're trying to sort of see it completely. Using every sense we have. Every sense we have. Okay? Thank you very much.
So, somebody has been waiting in this corner for a long time. Why don't we get that one to you, and then please go ahead.
Yeah. Are you all, by the way, let me just take the temperature of the room for a moment. Are you folks okay with the conversation going like this?
Yes.
Okay. So, and I see some people that are not. We have different options, one of which is to, you know, I was thinking in my mind, which is very unreliable, that maybe we do a little more yoga this morning and finish with the lying down. Okay. And so would that be all right if at a certain point we bring this conversation to a close and then go back into practice? Okay. So we'll try to find, again, the middle way between. But this is important. I don't want those of you who go, oh, could we do more practice? This is practice. Okay? This is talk meditation. This is talk yoga. It's as important as sitting in class or doing yoga on the floor. So please.
Okay. I suffer from ADD, and I'm not
I'm sorry, say that part again.
I'm suffering from ADD.
Yeah.
Okay.
And what was the second part? You bet you guess you're not the only one. From the perspective of the meditative traditions, we're all suffering from ADHD big time. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Now, when you say that the instruction for open meditation, open self meditation, I felt just like getting free answers to my daily life experiences. Confusion, jumping from one object to the other, free. And my life experience is starting something and then something I remember it. I have to do something else before forgetting, shifting to the left. That's a subject and forgetting the first one and ending with half things I learned. So I don't know if I have a feeling that there is special meditation is can be cured, but I don't know the
a cure.
A cure.
That's what I thought. A cure.
Yes. For this, if I will get the you know accurate instructions how to use it.
That's putting a lot of weight on my shoulders. So you want a cure for attention deficit?
No, I just want a cure for maybe I'm practicing for many years, concentration meditation,
when you say concentration meditation, what do you mean? What are you?
Vipassana
is not concentration.
I try to be concentrated on.
So you pretty much stay with the breath.
Yes.
Use the breath as an object of attention.
Or
sound. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So pretty much staying with one sense or another, but not the open presence thing. Well, I've never heard anybody ask for a cure for ADHD, so it made me kind of feel like, well, maybe I should invent one on the spot. And it struck me that the way you described it, we're continually interrupting ourselves, okay? And so we start out with one thing, and then we get distracted. We distract ourselves, and then we get involved in something else, and then this doesn't get completed, and then something else distracts us again. And so there's a very complex field of unfolding all the time. What's the cure for that? Well, I had never heard anybody ask that question before, but I would say I don't know about cure, but one thing that might be really valuable is to learn. Teach yourself how to hold it all in awareness without having it have to be different. Then it might actually influence your ability to remember what you were doing 3 steps back and finish it. Because the mind is just that way. But it's really a matter of remembering. And that's one of the meanings of the word mindfulness in Pali, sati. Part of it means remembering. Remembering what's on your mind. And what's on your mind, you've probably noticed, comes and goes very quickly. Have you noticed that? So how many of you have noticed, actually, that one moment, like you were having this great insight, or at least something was happening, and the next moment you couldn't remember what it was? Anybody have that experience? Look around. Okay? So, but that's a skill that can be cultivated to a degree. We don't know to what degree, and it's probably different for all of us because we're different. But you see, that would solve the problem immediately because you've got all these things going on, but you have the one awareness that's holding it all. Then, if you take note of the different elements that are constantly moving and changing and so forth, maybe you'll find some ways to thread them into connected. Because we haven't spoken about it yet, but my intention is that as we move to the last phase of the retreat, and the retreat's just been so fast that, you know, it takes time to unfold these things. It's not all about being. I said it at the beginning. It's also about doing. But without cultivating the domain of being, the domain of doing is very chaotic and scattered. And sometimes we're doing what we most shouldn't be doing, and we're not doing what we most need to be doing, and we're insensitive to the environment, so we inwardly and outwardly, so we often don't even get good feedback from ourselves that maybe we need to change direction. If you were to actually cultivate this capacity of open presence or choiceless awareness, just hold it all and not take it personally, and don't beat yourself up about, you know, how distracted you are, then that awareness is not necessarily distracted at all. The awareness is not the same as the contents of awareness, the objects of attention. And so you've got a new way to be in relationship to all of the coming and going that you find so hard to connect with. Is this easy? No. I'll tell you right now, it can't possibly be easy for any of us. And if you are describing yourself accurately, and it's a particularly difficult challenge for you, and it has been your whole life, then okay, but you chose to come here. So already you're way ahead of the curve. Most people with ADD don't choose to come to something like this, I'm guessing. Why not? Well, let's just say you chose to come here, whatever. You chose to come here, so you know something about why the cultivation, the systematic cultivation of mindfulness might be useful to you. So you've already begun, or you're continuing something that you've actually begun a long time ago. And we never stop learning, we never stop growing. And the consequences of that learning and growing often are greater balance, greater equanimity, greater clarity, and to a larger degree, maybe, greater integration of all these centripetal forces in our lives, so that we can actually remember what we were supposed to be doing in the first place. And that becomes a muscle you exercise. Sometimes you remember, sometimes you don't remember, and then sometimes you remember after you wanted to remember, but you couldn't, and then the next moment you remember. And maybe that's all okay, because what's the alternative?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, first I would also like to express my appreciation and gratitude to the generosity, gentleness, yours and your wife in running this retreat. It's interesting because I think one of the reasons why I'm here is more than 20 years ago, at Rutgers, I was given homework to pay attention to the ABC, activating event, emotional consequence C, and the belief that connects the event and the emotional consequences. And it was a eureka experience for me to realize how thinking, thoughts, the fleeting thoughts, affects the event. I will not go into detail. And since then, I was curious about having to pay attention. 2 weeks from now, I'm supposed to give a lecture, workshop, for students at the Israeli version of MIT, Technion. And one of the reasons I'm here is I read that MBSR is more effective with stress management than CBT. And the question that I have is, in order to bring forth the effectiveness of MBSR, I need to run a retreat, a workshop, or there are certain, techniques, or in a lecture, a way of showing that by focusing attention in a certain way, you, for example, not just show the difference between demandingness and preference. For example, a student who has stress anxiety, you can show it, you can explain to him that by demanding that he will succeed in every test in life, he creates extra stress. Then if you show him that by ignoring the demand, preference. So the question is, how do I go in Hebrew we have to say, Chanoch Lanah Lefi Darko. You need to teach the student according to his ways. And we are having now a new generation. I mean, I don't have the time to run a retreat.
No. And they won't come anymore.
Is there a two-thirds version of MBSR, or
I get you. Yeah. So mindfulness and MBSR are different. MBSR is a form, one skillful way of bringing mindfulness to certain populations of people. So if you're scheduled to give a lecture at the Technion, all you've got is the lecture, and you want to touch their hearts in some way. That's your question. And open up the sort of possibility of engagement around the cultivation of mindfulness as being valuable to their lives. So, I do that all the time. You know, that's what I do, is try, whenever I have to give a talk, to drop underneath the talk so that people walk out and they may not even know what the talk was, but they have some kind of feeling that they were touched by it. You know what I'm saying? Maybe just enough to sort of Google the word mindfulness, I don't know. But that something says, this is important. It may not be a technique to reduce my stress. Although, you know, often in a lecture, I'll take 10 minutes or so and do a guided meditation right in the middle of the lecture. Whether you feel comfortable doing that is all of the story, because, you know, it's best to not get into foreign territory when you're in the middle of giving a lecture. But if you feel comfortable with it, drawing on, was that Albert Ellis's work that, okay, so drawing on whatever it is that you know. And you probably know that Albert Ellis got very into the connections between his model and Buddhism later in his life.
Yeah, he actually talked about it.
Yeah. I actually had two very long conversations with him on the phone about it. But be that as it may, the real challenge here is always the real challenge. If you're used to lecturing, you know what it is. It's like, how do you find some place inside yourself that's so authentic that it's going to meet the authentic in the other? And then almost what you say doesn't matter. But if you're shaping it based on what you know, what you not just know here, but you've eaten and tasted and digested, then that comes through in every aspect of your being, your body, how you carry yourself, your tone of voice. And I only met you 2 days ago, but I sort of know enough about you from what you communicated to me that you have a certain cleverness, certain way to put things together that might be surprising to students. And it's always a good thing to surprise the students and in a way where they don't feel criticized or put down, but where they feel like, oh, new possibilities that they haven't considered. And since the students nowadays have been born into a totally digital world, the analog life, they never experienced life without digital devices. And so their brains may actually be very different from the brains of the older people in this room who have, you know, when the telephone was like, you know, and then there was the fax machine, which like is incredible. So I think the short answer is good luck and just to trust in your own genius to thread those needles. And if you're true to yourself, they're going to get it. Because most people who lecture to them, they're using kind of like, they're trying to put information inside their head. And we are in the age of information, of too much information, very little knowledge, even less understanding, and wisdom, forget about it. So, but what's the use of information if it doesn't come to understand knowledge and understanding and wisdom? So if you can embody that, even the tiniest little bit, they're going to be touched by that. And it's a planting seed. It's not like you have to run a stress reduction course for them. You're helping them to awaken to something that then they will have all sorts of digital ways of finding out more about mindfulness than you might think possible before you get home at the end of the day.
Thank you. That is really helpful.
You're welcome. Do you have it? You have to speak louder.
I pay attention from the beginning, from the first day to come, almost count the houses for us.
meditation, even though they, you gave all the space to the experience and to the retreat, I realized that you speak, you count, or you giving us every day to know that tomorrow is the end, today is quiet.
Because today's the end of the retreat. And we will be speaking about that this afternoon. So you know that anyway. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. It's a way of reminding us how precious the present moment is, how precious us being here all together like this really is.
It's a question about figures.
Well, keep it personal. Just never mind a lot of us. How about just you? Just little old you. Okay.
So every time you, for me, it's not necessarily that you're making me appreciate the moment. It's also sometimes. But sometimes it's to arrive at the pain.
It creates anxiety, it generates anxiety?
Pain.
Yes.
You know, there is a big narrative in my family, because of the whole world, that we never say goodbye. And when we separate, my grandma, she teach me to look at her when I had to say goodbye and walk like this. Never.
Oh, walk backwards. Sure.
And then
so that you're always maintaining contact.
Yes, like Shinjitai, it's not the name of the book of the river in Egypt. Limai that we are saying goodbye. And
for good.
Yes. Because the last time she said goodbye to her mother and all her parents, they went to the
concentration.
Auschwitz, yes. So in my family, it's a big issue to say goodbye.
Well, I'm so glad you brought this up because this is my first retreat in Israel and it's going to end this afternoon. So your bringing this up really helps me to think about, okay, how am I going to thread this needle or how are we going to collectively say goodbye without saying goodbye? And it turns out it's not that hard, okay? How many of you have been in the United States? How many of you either went to university yourself or have a child that went to the university in the United States? So what do we call a graduation ceremony in the United States? What's the word for it? It starts with a C.
Commencement.
Commencement. What does the word commencement mean?
Beginning.
It means beginning, yeah. So the end is called the beginning, okay? It's the same with goodbye. Goodbye is not goodbye. It's at the end of this retreat is not the end of anything. Okay? It's us, we are still connected. It's just a bigger space in which we'll be connected. I'll be on one continent, you'll be on another continent, we'll all be wherever we are. But that doesn't mean that the retreat's over in anything but a literal name and form kind of way. Yeah, name and form, it's over. And tomorrow something else will be happening. And you know that as well as I. But how you hold the emotion of it, how you hold the meaning of it in your family, that's something that you can actually cultivate and investigate. And in some sense, if you don't mind my saying this, and maybe it will sound a little arrogant, but it's not meant to be that way, heal. Whatever the pain is there, to bring it more into this spirit of investigation. Not to deny anything or to suppress anything or to reject anything, but to actually hold it with greater love and greater wisdom. And to be aware of how many issues you and probably many, many other people have about comings and goings. And this is really, really fundamental. And I always end our retreats with something about this, because I take it very seriously. I didn't just come here to have a weekend with you. I mean, you know, I don't need to do that. I came out of love for a certain something that I had no idea what it was, because as Nava and I were talking about, like, well, what could I do as long as I'm here? And I'm not here by myself. I'm here with my wife, Myla, who's sitting over there, and we're going to be doing something together tomorrow about mindful parenting. But one of the questions was, well, what should I do? Come to Israel and just give one talk? I mean, it seems like a waste, so, because I don't come very often. So maybe should do a number of different things that might actually help or contribute to work that's really already being done to a huge degree here in Israel. We can feel it. I mean, it's beautiful. It's insanely beautiful. And it's also integrated. We've got neuroscience. We've got conflict resolution. We've got, you know, all sorts of different dimensions going on here. We've got Tovana, you know, all sorts of different streams. And look how many people came to this retreat. And if they couldn't find a hall this big in Israel for a long time. That's why we've been having, you know, whatever physical problems we've been having. It's like, you know, hard to find a space this big to get us all lying down on the ground and on the floor. And that was done. And the amount of work that, just look at the amount of cloth that's surrounding us so that we can have a kind of more peaceful experience as opposed to looking at cement or I don't know what. A lot of work has gone into making this happen, and just like those Tibetan sand paintings, it will all be brushed away tomorrow. This will not exist. So we are, you know, in a very, very precious nexus here together. We've come together. Many of you, I'm guessing, don't know each other. But now you know each other, probably even if you don't know each other's names, because you've sat together, because we've walked together, because we've eaten together. All in silence, so, you know. And yet, you may know more about each other than you know about people that you talk to a lot. So maybe this is one more evolutionary piece of whatever is going on in this society. And every single person is going to, by definition, play multiple roles in this unfolding. And so in that sense, nothing's ending at all. It's just everything changes, you know. The day comes to an end, but then it's night, and then the next day comes. And when you've experienced that kind of trauma in the family, I mean, trauma is not a good enough word. That's why the word Holocaust is used. How to hold that respectfully and yet not be 3 or 4 generations later still so scarred by it that it's hard to function in certain ways. This is, you know, a question that I think mindfulness and heartfulness have a great deal to offer as a practice. And so we will speak a little bit more about that this afternoon as we move into recognizing that we're tying things together and we will all be like dispersing, and yet at the same time, I'm guessing, I mean, I don't want to assume anything, but I'm guessing that most of us in some way have been touched. We signed up for some reason, maybe very mysterious. We actually moved our bodies here and made space for it to happen. And then, you know, one of the things that you're going to have to deal with when you go home is people are going to ask you, well, what did you do on this great retreat? And if you start telling, well, we ate 2 raisins. You left home and I had to take care of the kids so that you could eat 2 raisins? Oh, well, we did more than that. We walked very, very slowly. And then when you weren't walking, what were we doing? Oh, we were sitting. And were you talking? No, we weren't talking. This is going to go over really great in society, you know? Oh, I see. So I'll make some comments about that this afternoon, about how to sort of gracefully move back into the sort of other domains of our lives in ways that keep the practice alive, basically, and then don't turn this into some nice sort of postcard workshop memory that will become just that, some nice, sweet memory, rather than a living engagement with life that emphasizes the interconnectedness that's already here among us in this room. Okay? Which, even if all of us scattered to the ends of the earth tomorrow, that interconnectedness would not be reduced by one iota. That's just the nature of reality. And when we understand that in some deep way, then the world is already different, and we will treat each other differently, and not just the each other that's in this room, or the people that sort of we like the way they talk or anything, but even the people that we have the hardest time. And we will not be doing it out of pity or charity for them. We will be doing it out of compassion for and wisdom for ourselves. And realizing that there's no difference. And how that operationalizes is very complicated, very complex, and no one really has any answers. And we don't maybe need answers so much as we need questions. And to keep asking the fundamental questions and to keep looking where the questions are pointing and investigating and learning how to rest in this deep capacity that we have that never gets any education or any schooling or any exercise, and that is awareness, plain and simple, pure awareness. And then it is applicable to virtually every human experience, as far as I can see. And also just to say, there's no one right way to do this practice, so it's not like, oh, well, let's all lockstep follow John Kabat-Zinn or anybody else. No, we have to learn from each other. Yes, practice with teachers that we respect, really listen very deeply, practice the way they practice, but ultimately it's about making the practice our own, not imitating anybody else or following some catechism or some, you know, sort of rule book. And the world, as I've been suggesting many times in this very short retreat, the world really needs this, in my view, really needs it. The children need it, the parents need it, the government needs it, the dispossessed need it, the alienated, the imprisoned. And it's an interesting koan, who are the imprisoned anyway? You know, it may not necessarily be just the people behind bars. And sometimes they are, if you've done any work in prisons, I mean, as I have, I mean, sometimes they seem freer than when you walk out of the prison and encounter other people.